With so many options, why choose Arizona State University?
For me, the only online option was ASU because of the quality. Their faculty was really involved with their students and care about your personal journey. The dedication to my personal development from my professors, that's been extremely valuable to me.
Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online. That's a degree better. Explore more than 350-plus undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu. At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online. That's a degree better. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. The hard part was over. More than a ton of money had been successfully taken from the safekeeping of the Charlotte, North Carolina Loomis Fargo vault by a single, tall, slightly scrawny man in a theft that had taken just over an hour to complete. It was October 4th, 1997, in a time before texting. If you wanted the attention of someone back then, you could buzz their beeper with your number or some prearranged code. That code thing was something Kelly Campbell had done repeatedly to bolster the confidence of the one thief in the Loomis facility. Despite appearances that would suggest otherwise, David Gant had pulled off the physical part of the heist himself. The cameras that had witnessed it were just videotaping, not live streaming for anyone to watch in real time, and he would take care of them. Kelly and her gangster friend, plus a few extra people he hadn't expected, were on hand at the prearranged rendezvous point and unpacked the money-laden white van he had loaded. Their job was to hide the pallets of cash until the dust settled. But his part was done. David was in a hurry. He handed these men his Loomis keys, and he and Kelly, the fresh love of his life, were driving as fast as the law would allow out of North Carolina. The plan, as the three who had planned this had agreed, was for him to use none of the local transportation hubs for his getaway. Because, really, only Gant was going to be fingered early on. And if Gant knew anything, it was that the cops would look first at the manifestos of airlines, trains, and buses out of Charlotte to try to figure out where he had gone. So the plan was to drive that night to Columbia, South Carolina, and fly from there to Mexico, where he would wait out the flurry of post-heist excitement, after which his darling would join him. She would have two-thirds of the take with her, and they would live happily ever after on a beach somewhere where no one knew them or what they had done or how they had come to live so well. When the couple got to Columbia, David had expected that Kelly would hand him a plane ticket or a confirmation of his reservation on some flight. She hadn't thought of it. Maybe that was supposed to be his job, but he hadn't thought of it either. They were in a slight pickle. The airport in Columbia had no flights out that night that went to Mexico or anywhere else. It was closed. Hours earlier, these geniuses had stolen some $17.3 million with no one the wiser. That included them.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This 1997 armored car warehouse robbery would go down in history as the nation's third largest heist. It would be the largest of its kind in Charlotte, a city that was growing into a formidable banking capital where major financial institutions put their headquarters. The heist would be remembered as far too easy to pull off and is said to have dramatically changed everything about how companies who handle and transport large sums of money for banking institutions operate. Because what David Gant did, in part, was expose every flaw in the system. He didn't have to be a master criminal to do that. All he had to do was be a guy who made $360 a week to count and shuffle great gobs of cash around Charlotte banks. He'd been driving an armored car route for Loomis for years and had gotten used to being around money that wasn't his. He was also a guy who had bills to pay and little hope of ever getting ahead. In fact, he'd say that working around money was less appealing than you think. But money had its advantages. Any fool could see that.
Today marks 25 years since the famous Loomis Fargo heist here in Charlotte. Back in 1997, former Kings Mountain resident and a Iraq War veteran. Now, this entire story even inspired the movie Masterminds, which was made back in 2016, starring Owen Wilson, Jason Sudeikis, Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, it was such a crazy time. It was bungled. It was a comedy, you know, when you think about what they did.
It didn't have to be. It could have been unsolved to this day if only those involved hadn't been greedy and feckless. In fact, in time, the robbery would be referred to derisively as the Hillbilly Heist, and those who pulled it off as the gang who couldn't think straight. And those were the nice things that people said about the thieves, who appeared to be ordinary people who wanted a more surefire way to get rich than playing the lottery every week. I'm gonna guess they were tempted and weak instead of dumb and dumber. But you get to decide that. Let's start with David Gant, a man who had been married a while to a woman named Tammy. They had leaned hard on the credit cards early on and were now living on a tight budget, which Tammy controlled. So life wasn't as much fun as it had been pre-marriage for David, who worked a lot of overtime trying to get ahead. He'd been a bit of a loner, a quiet redhead who always led a working man's life, one sustained by low-paying employment. He'd been raised in a just-getting-by household. He'd been married for 5 years. He had met a new woman, Kelly Campbell, when they both worked at Loomis, where they would lunch together, take smoke breaks, hang out. It's not really clear why Kelly left her employ at Loomis a year before. There were some rumors that she had been invited to leave, but she and David kept in touch after that. Who launched the heist idea has a few retellings, but it appears that Kelly was likely the one who suggested to David just how easy it would be to walk away with some of that ever-present cash at Loomis. Later versions of the story have David being the mastermind of the heist, and I guess that could be true, that he figured out the finer details, even if it was her initial idea. All they had to do was figure out when, how much, and how they'd get away with it. It would mean that David would leave Tammy, of course, and that David would hide out and Kelly would join in Mexico with most of the proceeds. All good, except they would need a guy who knew something about laundering money, although Kelly said she knew somebody. His name was Steve Chambers. They decided it would be best if David and Steve never met and nobody knew full names. The better to keep things tight, you know, should the law ever ask. It would require little prep, really. Here's David Gant.
The basic plan was for them to get me a fake ID, which we did, which back then was way easier. What I would do was we'd pick a Saturday, and I would basically empty the vault. At first, they only wanted me to take, I think he said 250,000, and then he came back, I'll get 1 or 2 million. I'm like, no, we're not doing that. If I do this, I'm going to take enough money so that I won't have to ever come back, because I won't be able to. As it worked out, the original plan was I wanted to get at least 15, which worked out pretty good. And it was like, here's your five, here's your five. Just make sure you deliver my five. Anything that's left after that, you can keep it. I only want my five. And they were, oh, yeah, that'd be great.
Plus, Kelly had straight up promised that she was ready to go anywhere with David and their life together would be peachy. They even shared a kiss one time while in her pickup truck a week before the big score. That's all they had done. That and come up with a beeper code so they could secretly communicate their impending future. It was 1-4-3. I love you, having 1, 4, and 3 lettered words. How romantic. That Saturday in October had been chosen because it was a night when David was scheduled to be vault manager and would be on the premises alone, aside from a trainee. It was also a night when all the money that came in was already pre-stacked and pre-sorted. The bills were all non-sequential and unmarked, their serial numbers unrecorded and all ready to be distributed to banks and, particularly, to automatic teller machines. David gave no indication that anything was different when he went about his job that day. Even at home, before he'd gone to work, all had been normal in the few days before. He had helped his wife grocery shop, he'd kissed her goodbye, he even made a dental appointment for later in the month. For most of the day, Kelly had interrupted his flow by beeper and by phone, urging him not to chicken out.
I'm not sure if I've got the guts to do it, because I know as soon as I put that first dollar in that van, I can't go back. If I steal $1, I've got to steal them all.
He had decided to steal them all. He took advantage of the trainee's inexperience when the shift was over by pretending to completely close the vault. Then David waved goodbye to the new guy, who went directly to his car and out the gate. That's when David moved an unmarked white van to the loading area, returned to the vault room, and spent an hour moving the money into the van. Kelly, meanwhile, was waiting with Steve and some others he had recruited to help stash the cash. They were parked outside the facility, obviously anxious, as Kelly sent 1-4-3s repeatedly to David's pager, which was a sign for him to call her from within. Finally, he told her to stop. He had work to do. When he was done, he remembered to enter the security area and take 2 videotapes that had been recording all that had been going on in the vault room. He threw them into the white van and drove the now heavily laden truck to the back gate, which didn't rise as it should when the van approached. After several abortive tries, he circled to the front gate, which would require physically getting out of the van to unlock the hefty array of Loomis keys he had on him. According to Jeff Diamant's Heist, it was around 8 o'clock and David was tired. Here, too, the chain-link gate refused to budge. Those who had been waiting were watching, and one of the assembled drove over to the gate, averting his face so his identity would be concealed. Finally, the gate gave way. Then a caravan of 3 cars drove across Charlotte to the hidden parking lot behind Reynolds & Reynolds, a printing business. David snatched $50,000 to tide him over in Mexico, forgot about the videotapes in the back of the van, and handed the wad of something like 200 keys to those waiting and got in the car with Kelly. The little bunch left behind realized they had no idea which key fit the van and spent a few rattled minutes trying every key to see which one opened it. They began unloading the money into plastic barrels, boxes, and crates, packing every crevice of their cars. There was so much money, literally and figuratively, because $11 million of it was stacked in $20 bills, that they had not brought enough cars to hold it. So they decided to leave wrapped ones and fives in the van when they drove it a short way and left it, still running and unlocked, for anyone to find. They, too, had not given a second thought to the security videotapes that David had taken from the scene. They left those behind. Somewhere along the way to South Carolina, David and Kelly realized they had made no provision for getting that kind of cash through the airport. So they stopped at a convenience store, bought some pantyhose, which they cut up to make a money belt of sorts for David to tie around his waist. Do remember, this was before September 11th and x-ray machines and hand-checking passengers became commonplace. Now, once inside the empty airport, with all the money that would fit, $25,000, attached to him, David had to do some rethinking since he couldn't hop aboard a flight as planned. Kelly said she was too tired to take him anywhere. They settled on hailing him a cab to take him to a bus station where he would catch a bus that would then take him to Atlanta's Hartsfield Airport. Before they parted, they agreed that Kelly would show up at a certain payphone at 1 p.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays in case David needed to talk. There was no discussion of everlasting love. They simply said goodbye, and he got on the bus. From here on in, he would go by the name on his fake passport, Mike McKinney. In Atlanta, he got a flight to New Orleans and then got on another plane to Cancun, a place where he knew no one and did not speak the language. He directed his Mexican cabbie to take him to a fancy hotel where he could sleep and wait for Kelly to show up with $10 million. He carried no bags.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to get myself up and ready and go to therapy or whatever. Even to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.
Steve Chambers, the supposed expert in money laundering, had recruited a few relatives for the cash stash. He paid $100,000 to each of them to rent storage units in their own names or in the names of their family members, to open bank accounts or safe deposit boxes, to bury some of it, hide it in attics. Because $17 million in medium and small denominations is bulky business. His warning to them as he left them to it was, don't be stupid, don't flash the cash around, don't make any huge purchases that would alert the authorities, who were just now waking up to what had happened inside Loomis Fargo. Now for his part, David had been told by Kelly that her friend Steve was a big-time and well-connected gangster, an accomplished money launderer and skilled gambler. He was, in fact, none of those things. A small-time bookie who was even at that moment fighting charges he had written a slew of bad checks, he and his wife Michelle and their children lived in a manufactured home in the lesser suburbs of Charlotte. He went home that Sunday morning after the partial cash dispersal to that trailer to count more of the money into the night and bury it in his backyard. On Sunday morning, a security guard noticed that the facility's front fence was open. So too, the warehouse door. He alerted the necessary authorities, who arrived to find the vault unopenable, as David had, before leaving, put a time lock on it, set for Monday morning. Law enforcement noticed that all the keys were missing, as was a company van. There'd been no sign of forced entry and, well, yes, the two videotapes in the security office were missing, a third videotape was intact and still recording the goings-on in the vault room. And there, with the FBI present, because this was federally insured money that belonged to federally insured banks, everyone watched as David Gant staggered for more than an hour under 2,700 pounds of money as he lugged it from the vault to his waiting van. The tape did not reveal anyone else in the room, but authorities wondered if someone was off camera directing Gant or maybe holding his family hostage. His pickup truck was in the facility's parking lot, Inside its ashtray, they found his wedding ring. Here's Mark Rossi, one of the special agents on the case in a documentary called The Unperfect Crime, America's Dumbest Heist.
Your concern immediately is with the missing body, with David Gant. Was he abducted? Was he harmed? Was he forced to do something against his will? Is he still on the premise? Is he locked inside the vault?
They wondered, too, if the wedding ring was a sign from David, some kind of message to indicate what had happened to him. Hard to say. When the vault was finally opened, it was empty, from a documentary by Robbers IQ.
Facing a challenge, the FBI re-examined the weekend of the heist, complicated by the Coca-Cola 600 NASCAR race in Charlotte. Sorting through the influx of out-of-town visitors, potential leads were challenging to discern.
For the first few days, they did as David had suspected they would do, checking all the ways out of town and then checking all the storage facility rental applications. No luck. They interviewed his panicky wife, Tammy, who had already alerted police on Sunday morning that her husband was missing. It didn't take law enforcement long to decide she knew nothing. She stood by his innocence. Special agent in charge, William Perry, filled in a few more blanks.
The picture we were getting from the family does not seem to fit the profile of somebody that's going to take $17 million by himself and have a plan of action and a destination to go to.
Now, FBI Special Agent John Wydra weighed in.
This is a man who'd never been in trouble with the law, was honorably discharged from the military, worked overtime on a regular basis. From all outward appearances, would not be a willing participant in this type of crime.
By late Monday, the unmarked and unlocked Loomis van was found less than 10 miles from the Loomis warehouse, within spitting distance of the Reynolds & Reynolds printing facility. Inside was $3.3 million that the thieves had left in the van, the keys to the vault, David's Loomis-issued service weapon, and the videotapes of his hour of industry on Saturday night. One thing was sure, they decided. If Gant did it, he couldn't have done it alone. It was just too much money. And if he'd been coerced, then who had gotten to him and how? They were now ready to start widening the probe. They even had a name for the operation, Charlotte. The next order of business was to talk to every Loomis employee and make lists of those who had recently worked there. David had been a quiet guy, they all said, not overly bright. Fact is, no one he knew fingered him for being the brains behind this huge theft. Believing he was even involved was hard enough. Kelly Campbell's name, however, came up repeatedly as employees remembered their unusual closeness. When Kelly was contacted by agents who were treating the matter as routine, she decided this was a good time to lie. Mark Rossi again.
The interesting thing with Kelly Campbell is that you had these external people saying that they were close, that they were good friends, that they would have lunch together, and that even after she had left Loomis Fargo, they stayed in contact. But that's not what Kelly Campbell told us. She painted a different picture, that they weren't all that particularly close, and that they really hadn't maintained much of any contact since she had left. We had an obvious discrepancy here, and we had some doubts about the truthfulness of Kelly Campbell.
So they put her under some limited surveillance. A week into the investigation, the FBI contacted the John Walsh-hosted Fox TV show America's Most Wanted and arranged for an almost immediate inclusion of the robbery with a piece of the videotape and David's face to be shown to a nationwide audience. All agents in the Charlotte office were ready to take calls and move this case along. It was scheduled to air on the East Coast immediately after the conclusion of the American League Baseball playoff game between the Cleveland Indians and the Baltimore Orioles. The game, however, was tied at the end of 9 innings, and the game went into overtime, thus canceling the show, at least in the area where the FBI figured David Gant still had to be. Then Loomis posted a $500,000 reward for information on the heist. That's when the telephone started to ring. A few of the tipsters hoping for reward money in the Loomis robbery mentioned a man named Eric Payne, who had been spotted spending a bit of newfound wealth. He had bought expensive airline tickets and was taking exotic vacations. He bought a new mobile home and a big screen TV, a Harley Davidson, and a $35,000 Chevy Tahoe with a stack of $20 bills. He had bought his wife a new nose and bigger breasts. His sister also asked for the gift of larger breasts, and he paid for those as well. When asked, he said he had come into an inheritance, but the FBI could find no recent family member of Payne's who had died. He worked at Reynolds & Reynolds, which couldn't be a coincidence, but the FBI couldn't find any connection between him and David Gant. Then came a bunch of phone calls about a couple in Gaston County who had just moved into the wealthy enclave called Cramerton. The couple recently bought a 7,000-square-foot, $635,000 house in a gated community. The wife was running around town in a new sporty BMW convertible while she got used to her new breast implants. She had gifted her stepfather a fancy pickup. They put Pabst Blue Ribbon in the wine cellar and asked the home sellers to leave their Velvet Elvis. They got lavish parties, and for Christmas that year, the wife had been given a 3-carat diamond ring costing $43,000. The couple had also quickly bought a discount furniture store across from the Mecklenburg County Courthouse in Charlotte. The family was telling everyone that the brawny husband had played for the Dallas Cowboys, hence all that money. Yet no football fan on the block had ever heard of him. And the neighbors had heard just weeks before, this family had been living in a mobile home in a lesser suburb of Charlotte. Their names were Steve and Michelle Chambers. All that conspicuous consumption wasn't the dumbest thing the Chambers did, which, remember, was as hypocritical as it was idiotic. Steve Chambers was the one who had admonished his cohorts not to spend too frivolously. Seems that, on the Monday after the heist, Michelle Chambers had carried a briefcase full of $20 bills into a nation's bank, one of the banks that lost money when Loomis was robbed in Mount Holly, North Carolina. She asked a teller how much she could deposit before any paperwork had to be filed. The teller told her the limit was $10,000. Michelle then deposited $9,500 in a new account and made a point to say, "No worries, this wasn't drug money." The teller, suspicious, sent a suspicious activity report that day to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, a part of the Treasury Department, which then routed it to the FBI, which sent it on to its office in Charlotte. That took a while. In the meantime, despite the Chambers' frequent trips to banks to deposit money, no one could tie the Chambers' money to the robbery. But the house in the private enclave certainly commanded their attention, which was tricky. Here's the Cramerton Chief of Police, David Young, on getting complaints from the neighbors about this unaccounted-for car they noticed.
In a small town, any vehicle that's not normally seen in a neighborhood becomes a suspicious vehicle. I think that was probably one of the biggest problems we had, understanding what was going on and trying to explain to residents who were calling about suspicious vehicles and trying to tell them what was going on without actually telling them what was going on.
That forced the FBI to do surveillance by air any time the Chambers left the house. They didn't seem to notice that either.
Not only are we dealing with reports of suspicious vehicles, now we got to come up with some reason for a plane flying low in the area.
The Chambers kept spending and kept roping in more people into the scheme to help open bank accounts and rent safety deposit boxes to hold the cash, thinking no one was noticing. The FBI now started plumbing high school yearbooks for leads and found that Eric Payne and Steve Chambers and Kelly Campbell had known each other a decade or so earlier. The agents visited Kelly again and pressed her to take a polygraph. She declined, but appeared anxious. Then a break. Standing on the steps of the courthouse in Charlotte one day, two agents noticed that Kelly was visiting her friends, the Chambers, out in front of the furniture company the couple now owned across the street. The agents got the license plate number of Kelly's new minivan and found that it was paid for by Robert Dean Wilson, a known alias of Steve Chambers. According to Diamant, they had used $20 bills to buy the car that sold for $14,220. Okay, now they were getting somewhere. By late January 1998, Kelly was continuing to put David off about when she was going to show up to join him, while his wife had still heard nothing and feared him dead. Growing paranoid, David moved hotels, then a little farther south to Playa del Carmen, then back to Cancun. He sometimes stayed for days inside his hotel room, only venturing out at night so he would be less recognizable. He stayed in touristy spots so he could eat at American restaurants like the Hard Rock Cafe, but was constantly afraid of being recognized. That America's Most Wanted episode had finally run on the East Coast. He listened to the Eagles' Hotel California all day, smoked cigarettes, and ate M&Ms to stave off his loneliness, knowing he was running out of ready cash and wondering where his share of the haul was.
I'm in Cancun and I'm moving from place to place. I'm starting to get concerned. This should have been easy. You can smuggle anything you want into Mexico.
Yeah.
Easy. Going south, easy as pie.
But Steve had already decided that David needed to be taken out of the picture, as the feds couldn't tie anyone else to the crime. He convinced Kelly to string David along while he procured a hitman. This proved easy. He had a buddy who had been in the military and would do it for a quarter mil. Turns out, it was the same guy who had given Steve his own birth certificate for David's fake passport, Mike McKinney. The plan was for McKinney, posing as a guy named Bruno, to drop off cash to David while he planned the killing. On McKinney's first trip to Cancun, he couldn't find David. McKinney didn't speak Spanish, and no one he spoke to knew where the red-headed American was. When he finally did meet David in Mexico, McKinney handed over $8,500. David balked. This would hardly do. Little did he know that the people who were laundering that cash, friends or cousins or their mothers, were making five times that for taking a single trip to the bank to get a cashier's check so that the Chambers could buy their next shiny doodad to solidify their status around town. Well, he didn't know, that is, until McKinney told him. After David learned from Mike McKinney that Steve and Michelle Chambers were spending that Loomis money like it was going out of style, he was as mad as he was helpless. He didn't have much cash and had to blow through the conservative amounts McKinney, aka Bruno, delivered on hotel rooms and food while he was stuck in limbo. A few more cash exchanges happened between Bruno and David while Bruno looked for help with the murder. He found an accomplice named Roberto, who happened to be a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. When Roberto was set to meet David, the American happened to be wearing a Steelers jersey. This created an immediate bond. And Roberto, who went by Gordo, didn't want to kill him anymore. More than that, he didn't want anyone else to kill him either. David explains,
One of the Mexicans he was working with came by my apartment. His nickname was Gordo. He's a big guy. And he says, you know that this guy is planning on killing you. I was shocked. And I was very naive. It made no sense. There was plenty of money for everybody.
Right. Why don't just pay you and just...
pay me and forget about me.
David didn't believe Kelly was in on this. Now what to do? The FBI, meanwhile, needed more evidence if they were going to arrest anyone. They were on hand when Michelle again brought fresh money, still wrapped with Loomis-looking bands around it, who threw the bands in the trash. Retrieved, one of the bands had been hand-initialed. Working back from that, the agents found that the initials were those of a woman who counted money in the Loomis Fargo vault but had not been employed there since the theft. It was telling. It was also probable cause, which they took to a federal judge who gave them permission to wiretap a lot of phones. This allowed them to see the beeper messages, decipher the coding for the scheduled telephone calls, and arrange to listen in to Kelly's conversations via that payphone. From Robber's IQ again.
Kelly Campbell and Steve Chambers eventually discussed Gant's impending call, arranging a coded numeric page to determine when and where Gant would call. The FBI aimed to capture Gant's voice on tape. However, when the scheduled call arrived, Kelly Campbell failed to appear at the designated payphone. Disappointed, the FBI prepared to end the wiretap. Just as they were about to conclude, Campbell informed Chambers that she had received a page from David Gant. This time, the FBI was ready. They intercepted the call, capturing Gant's voice and confirming he was still alive.
It wasn't long before the feds knew David was being set up to be murdered. They found out that he was in Cancun when he told his sweet angel Kelly where he could be found. This was both good news and bad news. They now knew where David was holed up, but they had to get to him before the hitman did. McKinney slash Bruno had arranged to bring some more money to David, though David wanted it all done in a public place. Negotiations were ongoing. After hastily coordinating with the Mexican authorities and Interpol, Agent Mark Rossi flew to Cozumel and arrested David on March 1st, 1998, as he was leaving his hotel.
He says to me, "Please tell me you're an FBI agent." And I said, "I am." And the next thing he said to me was, "We really need to talk." And I said, "Yes, we do." And then he told me, "I'm really glad to see you." And I told him that I was glad to see him also.
The news of the arrest was not made public until David was on his way back to Charlotte. At dawn on March 2, 1998, the FBI woke up the neighborhoods and trailer parks across the metro area, pulling in suspects. Mike McKinney was found at the Charlotte airport's Hampton Inn, waiting to get on a plane to Cozumel. If nobody talked, the FBI would have a lot more work ahead of them. But before Steve Chambers got out of his mini mansion's front door, he was making deals to tell everything. Little did he know that David Gant had already told Special Agent Rossi everything on the plane ride home. One of the people caught in the dragnet was Jeff Guller, a local defense attorney who represented Steve Chambers in his bad check case and seemed to be on hand to give Chambers a lot of dubious legal advice. He also was paid $10,000 to stash some suitcase full of money in his office. The hitch was, of course, that he knew it wasn't above board cash, and the advice he dispensed occasionally showed Steve how to skirt the law. He also seemed to be helping Steve get a pardon for his own past felony transgressions via a bribe to the right people. Guller was the unexpected victim of the wiretaps that had been placed on Steve's phones and was thus collateral damage. Include him in the 21 who were eventually indicted for their part in the Loomis Fargo heist. 8 were major players, and the rest, aside from lawyer Guller, were relatives of the main 8 who had participated in money laundering schemes. No one got bail at first, despite their willingness to deal with the government, because of this simple matter that there was still so much money unaccounted for. Agents, meanwhile, had been looking for the money. According to reporter Diamant, in those first hours after the arrest, while unpeeling the Chambers home stash, they found $565,602 in a cardboard box in a desk drawer, $897,000 inside one safe deposit box, and $454,000 in another, plus $770,000 stuffed into blue plastic barrels and storage facilities. Diamant reported that during that first week, the FBI found $9.8 million, which, added to the $3.3 million left in the Loomis van, meant they had recovered nearly $13 million of the original $7.3 million. Everyone pleaded guilty, except for Guller, who fought the charges. David Gant was convicted of bank larceny and money laundering. He was sentenced to 7.5 years in federal prison and fined $26,000. For a time, it looked as if he and Tammy would reconcile. They didn't. She divorced him while he was serving time. Steve Chambers was sentenced to 11 years, 3 months, and fined $3.5 million. His wife, Michelle, got 7 years, 8 months, and was ordered to pay $4.8 million in restitution. Kelly Campbell was sentenced to nearly 6 years in prison and ordered to pay back $4 million. She was also required to undergo mental health and drug treatment. Eric Payne, the Reynolds & Reynolds employee who had waited for the crew to show up on the night of the robbery, got 6.5 years in prison. Michael McKinney, a.k.a. Bruno, was sentenced to 11 years, 3 months for conspiring to murder for hire. Jeff Guller was found guilty of money laundering and sentenced to 8 years in prison. He was subsequently disbarred. 14 of the 21 convicted were ordered to pay some kind of restitution, which, if ever paid, would come to about $19 million. According to the Associated Press, which did some checking in 2022 with a clerk in the federal court of the Western District of North Carolina, Loomis has received only $978,983.79 of that. A few of the defendants, the lesser lights, if you will, have paid off their indebtedness. Most have not, though they have had their wages garnished in some way or have had their tax refunds withheld. There is no further punishment for those who do not repay what they took in 1997. Newsflash, we gave up debtors' prisons ages ago. Last he was heard of, David Gant was a heavy equipment operator in Jacksonville, Florida. Asked once if he would make the decision to rob Loomis again, knowing everything he knows now, he took a minute to respond.
Would I do it again? Yeah. Opportunity like that comes around once in a lifetime. Now that I'm already in prison and been judged and everything, I can be more honest and say, sure.
Oh, one last note. Post-conviction, all of the contents of the Chambers-Cramerton home were auctioned. A headline in the Sunday Charlotte Observer on February 21, 1999, read, Velvet Elvis worth $35 brings $1,650. It was history, I guess. All the proceeds from the sale of these 650 items went to Lloyd's of London, who had insured Loomis Fargo in case of theft. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Heist, the oddball crew behind the $17 million Loomis Fargo theft by Jeff Diamant. She watched a few documentaries on the topic, though she did not watch the goofball movie. She read newspaper accounts of the theft and its aftermath, mostly those that appeared in the Charlotte Observer and which went out over the wire services. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.